This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with a rabbit. We're going to be discussing Robert Heinlein. Rabbit, it's great having you back on.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Thanks.
So Robert Heinlein is a science fiction novelist, and we're going to be discussing his work. But I think besides his work, he's also has a lot of interesting ideas. And first of all, what originally got you interested in Heinlein? You started reading his books, but did his philosophical and political ideas have a major influence on you as well?
I started reading Heinlein, I think after reading a lot of John Derbyshire's columns. He would sometimes reference Heinlein in them, and so I got interested in it was basically something, the columns were basically along the lines of Heinlein's futurism and whatnot, and versus like what the world was like now instead. There was something along those lines. I would have to go back and find them, but then I just, I went into a phase several years ago when I just read, like 10 or 15 of his books, just like right in a row.
So is this fairly recently?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I had, familiarity with Heinlein, from his famous works like Stranger in a Strange Land and things like that. And then I'd also would always come across his books in thrift stores and antique stores and stuff, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and things like that. So I had some familiarity with him, but it wasn't until I read some other stuff about him that I became interested in revisiting that.
If you look at his sort of basic ideology, he's someone who kind of started out on the left, but he's very difficult to sort of pigeonhole ideologically, and that's what makes him interesting. He kind of flirted with libertarianism, but he's also been accused of having ideas that are maybe fascistic or even authoritarian. So he's someone who has had a lot of different ideas about politics and society and philosophy, but he's not someone who's easy to pigeonhole ideologically.
I completely agree, and I think that as someone who's a writer myself, I see that, like, for someone, especially in science fiction, to be constantly conducting all kinds of different thought experiments, it would seem to me that it could lead you to explore a lot of different ideas that sometimes contradict themselves just from exploring them personally. I think that that's true, that he's very difficult to pigeonhole, and it's almost like you can project and you can see whatever you want to see in him, depending on which works you look at and which perspectives that you prefer.
Which of his works made the biggest impact in you? Obviously, his most famous one is Starship Troopers.
I think that Starship Troopers had somewhat of an impact, but it was actually not the book itself that had the impact on me. I think in around 1980, he published a book called Expanded Universe, which was kind of where he talked about all of his books and then also included like his philosophy too. So it's kind of like where he explains a lot of his different other books and kind of expands on those ideas and answers critics and basically goes into much more detail about his own perspective. So I would say probably Expanded Universe was the one that had the most effect on me, but the other one would be Starship Troopers and also Farnham's Freehold. Probably would be another one, which is kind of a lesser liked Heinlein book, but one which I found pretty fascinating.
So Farnham's Freehold, it takes place in the future, and I haven't read it, but it's about whites who are enslaved by cannibalistic blacks. Would you say that the book is like a similarity to a sort of a Quentin Tarantino-like revenge porn fantasy, or does the author come across more coming from a kind of a racial perspective? Which one do you get more of, or neither? Because it's interesting about if you look at Heinlein's views towards race, on one hand, he was very, very strongly a supporter of civil rights in the 60s, but he's also been accused of being a racist as well.
Yeah, I would say that that book probably has a closer resemblance to like the Planet of the Apes type, but you know, the older version. Whereas basically the plot of it is there's a guy and his family, they have a bomb shelter, and there's a nuclear war, but somehow they get blasted into the future. You know, so when the war is over, they discover they're in the future, like several thousand years in the future, and basically the blacks are in charge, and they're like these, you know, technologically advanced, and then the whites are basically the they're like eunuch, you know, castrated servants, and you know, just kind of these weird helpers and slaves to them. So it does have, you know, it's been accused of being a racist book because the you know, the blacks in the future, that they practice cannibalism, and of course, you know, he gives them a certain dialect to speak in, you know, which would probably be considered offensive now, but also it also has something which I think is really key about this, is that in the he has his family has like a black I don't know, servant boy or something that lives with them initially, and then when they go to the future, you know, this servant boy that was loyal to them or whatever, you know, he is all excited, he you know, becomes tribal in a sense, you know, joins up with these new Africans, is accepted by them as so I find that to be very interesting, and then it also has the elements of these sort of you know, which you'd call now to be these cuckold whites, which are these white, you know, castrated servants that are basically traitors, you know, and they actually provide the security and that are, you know, constantly causing problems for this family and these characters, and then his own family are also essentially these, you know, weak traitors, and so he's basically left on his own with this other woman.
The book's actually been interpreted differently. So some people have interpreted it as basically a book trying to show white people what black people went through in the past. Then some people have also said that the book is a racist book because it shows blacks in a barbaric manner. So it's been interpreted in different manners. How personally do you think Heinlein, what point do you think he was trying to get across?
I think that it was sort of a mix. I think that to interpret these books as having, you know, very specific meaning, I don't think that's the way that science fiction writers generally operate. It's basically you write and you let your, you know, the ideas take you, you know, wherever they take you. So there's not going to be like someone trying to write a strictly political book with an outline of this is exactly where I'm going to take this. I just don't think that that's the way that it goes. So I think that there's a little bit of both in it. I think that there is, you know, in the same way that you can view Planet of the Apes as saying, like, you know, oh, you know, him in the future, he's getting a taste of, like, how other people were treated by whites in the past, you know, and the whole thing.
It's also important to point out the book came out in 1964, which was, like, at the pinnacle of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no question that, you know, Heinlein was in favor of civil rights, and he's made that very clear, but I think you can see if you read the book, it doesn't necessarily matter what his intentions were, because if you read it you can view it from the perspective of, gee, well, if these people took over, this isn't going to be good for us, you know? So that's one way that you can look at it, regardless of what he was trying to show.
And basically what they did with the slaves is that the men were castrated and the women were taken as sex slaves. And that's also, that's very similar to how slavery was practiced in the Muslim world.
Yeah, and I think it's something, you know, perhaps he was trying to envision something that was like a, what would be his vision of a technologically advanced civilization of, you know, of Muslims and Africans, if they kept their same, some of their same values while, you know, being advanced in technology, which kind of reminds me a little bit of some of Huntington's work, you know, where he talked about the clash of civilizations and how, like, Arabs and Islamic people were modernizing, but they weren't westernizing. Yeah. That's what, it kind of reminds me of that. I think that his main point was just basically that though these people are adopting a modern technological civilization, they're not adopting these Western European values like we think that they were going to. I think that's I'm not as well versed in his work, probably as I should be, but my rudimentary understanding of it, even back about 15 years ago, was that was the gist of it.
He has another book that's about a Asian takeover of America in the future, and it's like a dictatorship, and there's like a white resistance to that dictatorship.
I haven't read it. You know, I haven't read that book, but I've read about it.
So is this the one, the sixth column?
Okay. I think he has a few with similar themes like that, but that is, I guess that one was racially motivated. But of course, at that time, it was, racially motivated.
And this was published in 1949.
Yeah, so it was perfectly acceptable to be, to promote, insensitive ideas about Asians. I mean, even if you look at Dr. Seuss's old cartoons, I think that he had some. But also, that's a kind of a recurring theme in a lot of his work. So the moon is a harsh mistress is about a colony, like a prison colony that's on the moon and that decides to revolt. So it seems like that's a fairly recurring theme, and I don't know if the racial component of some of these stories is really meant to be any kind of central thing, or whether it's just a plot device for some of these stories.
What is the role that sex plays in his novels and work? He was very much an advocate of sexual freedom. There's definitely controversial sexual themes in his novels as well. Some of his books deal with incest and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, that to me is a lot of what makes his work interesting to me, because I find that he has he has a similar profile to a lot of my views, which in that he's very, he combines his ideas about sexual liberation. Like, he always said that, you know, the human body is not obscene. You know, we need to get to a point where we don't think that the human body is obscene. And then he combines those views with this fiercely nationalistic, anti-democratic views, which is what fairly close to my own views. Whereas normally when you see those people who have, anti-democratic, fiercely nationalist views, a lot of them are very traditionalist, and they want to curb degeneracy, execute gays and all that thing. It tends to be, so I think it's kind of an interesting mix of views that you don't see quite as often. Yeah, I mean, Heinlein had some pretty depraved stuff in his novels. It's almost like when you're reading them, you're almost not even expecting like where he's going to go. You know, like in Time Enough for Love, for example, he has the main character goes back in time and impregnates his own mother. And then there's something like that in so many of his books. The Farnham's Freehold has another one where there's a creepy scene with the dad and his daughter after the war, and she talks about like how she's attracted to him and stuff, but she's pregnant, but you know, but she wished it could have been his or something. It was just a really long, like, creepy scene that it was just kind of like that stuff is in there, and sometimes there's just no there's no reason for it to be in there. It's kind of like he just decided to go there, you know.
Does some of his books deal with like sex between adults and children or teenagers?
You know, I can't think of any offhand. The stuff that's most memorable to me is a lot of the incest stuff, which is, I guess, includes teenagers, but it's not like pedophilia or anything. There may be some of that, for all I know, but it doesn't appear to be anything he was really into. I know when he wrote those, a lot of those juvenile novels, like he was censored a lot in those, but looking at the stuff that was censored, it was just kind of stuff that was deemed too risque for like a very, but they were very like petty things from what I saw. Like,
there was a book, To Sail Beyond the Sunset, where his main protagonist convinces her husband to have sex with his two daughters.
Yeah, that seems pretty, that seems pretty Heinlein-esque. I just don't know, I don't know what the ages of the daughters are, you know, offhand, but like mother, son, and father-daughter incest seems to be a recurring thing. That's, it seems like there's a little bit of incest probably in, 7 or 8 of his novels just mixed in there somewhere.
I'll give another one is The Door into the Summer, where the hero in the book, he uses a combination of cold sleep and time travel to persuade the 11-year-old daughter of his business partner to take a cold sleep herself, and then when she reaches 21 so he can marry her.
Yes, and I have read that book, actually. I don't remember that particular part, and so it's kind of jogging my memory now, but like I said, that stuff is just kind of thrown in randomly. Like there's no real reason why that had to be in the story, but for some reason that's just a recurring thing for him. Yeah.
What was his sort of overall philosophy towards sexuality?
I mean, he was very open towards, almost any kind of sexuality and perversion. I think that he was very pro-sexual freedom, and I don't get any. He wasn't religious. He was atheist or agnostic. So he seemed to be very anti-traditionalist in some respects.
And he also, I know, he was in an open marriage with his wife.
Yeah, I'm not familiar that much with his personal life. But I'm not aware of what he did. He didn't really seem to me, though, that he was, he always kind of lived out in the middle of nowhere. So,
he was a nudist as well.
Yeah, but it seems to me that he probably wrote a lot about that kind of stuff because, it was kind of his outlet for it. It doesn't necessarily mean that he was doing tons of depraved stuff, but maybe he was, especially once he became famous and could go and do anything he wanted.
What are some of your personal views towards society? Should society put limitations on sexual freedom?
I'm very open and pro sexual freedom. I think that, any limits should be placed on it would be probably things which would be harmful to the nation in terms of outsiders, you know, like in terms of intermingling with the outsiders and things like that. I think that would be something that could be potentially an issue. But I'm very open.
Do you know the site? I think it was like Trad Youth. They wrote a critique of your alt movement called the Alt Left, and they said basically,
right,
the Alt Left is basically what it is like people can have S&M orgies as long as there's no diversity there. That was their summary of the Alt Left.
Yeah, well, you know, that'd be fine with me. But you know, what I always think is funny about those a lot of those critiques that people write up is they always say like, oh, like, you know, this guy is really just alt-right. Like, you know, he doesn't really differ with us on anything. But then as soon as you bring stuff up, then they're like, you know, of course they're not for that. You know, I'm not a traditionalist, and like your organization is called the Traditionalist Youth, you know, like we're not the same. So I don't know. I thought about responding to that, but I don't like to get into these infighting spats that you see between these groups. You just see, I mean, you know, you've been around this scene a long time, that you just see these people, the same people, go back and forth at it for years, and like I prefer to just like just ignore it and then focus on you know, my audience. Like, you know, I my audience is not these traditionalist people. Like, I'm not trying to convince these, you know, hardcore traditionalists and, like, religious conservatives to, in my point of view, I'm reaching out to people who are culturally similar to me, you know, that I identify with. You know, that's my audience.
What do you think about that essay Greg Johnson wrote a while back called West Coast White Nationalism? Do you see a lot of similarities to the themes that you've been writing about with your alt-left side?
Yeah, I definitely agreed with a lot of the stuff that was in it, and I think that it's similar to what I've been trying to convey, in that the different different communities of Europeans they're not going to all be have the same values, you know. So just like if you go in Europe, you know, France is different than England, you know, and Italy is different than Sweden and so forth. I think that a lot of people tend to have this misconception that that some kind of like a European society, or like a white nationalist civilization in the United States, that it's going to look like the U.S. South, you know, like it's going to have Georgia values or something. It's going to be hardcore Christian and racist, anti-homosexual, and I think that, you know, people who live in Oregon, Washington, and some of these other states their embrace of, you know, European nationalism or something is going to look completely different. You know, it's going to have a completely different setup. And I think that, you know, approaching it from this this perspective of, like, you know, worldwide, this is what, you know, this is what whiteness is. Like, it's this particular identity that exists in South Carolina or whatever. Like, I don't view things that way, and I think that there is going to be more and more of an identitarian movement that emerges in the Northwest that's kind of a mix between European nationalism and leftist cultural values.
Well, to go over some of the points he makes, the first one is it says, like, the people he's talking about, they have a higher SWPL quotient, which comes from stuff white people like. Does that apply to you?
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, you know, I used to live in Los Angeles. I like almost all of the stereotypical things that, you know, hipsters like and whatnot. That's when I almost like.
So you don't like NASCAR and Walmart?
No, absolutely not. Like, you know, if I have to go into a Walmart, it's like an emergency situation in the middle of the night, and like I feel like I have to take a shower afterwards. Like I'm like so disgusted by it. Like even just being in the Walmart parking lot is probably the most depressing place in the world, in my opinion. So yeah, no, I almost kind of cringe whenever I hear a lot of these, you know, right wing nationalists and stuff. You know, complain about hipsters and like you know, indie music and things like that, because it's just like, you know, a lot of that culture is what, you know, is what I come from, and some of it is pretty stupid, but, you know, I actually like. And kind of nostalgic for the, you know, some of like the late 90s and early 2000s, I guess, you know, white like hipster culture, because I feel like it was kind of a lot more like artsy and pretentious almost.
Well, it's become sort of absorbed into the like general consumer culture.
Well, exactly. It's also been very much dumbed down, you know, because I don't know how old you are, but if you're around my age, like, you know, that whole scene was, even the music scene, it was so much more intelligent. Like, these were people that were intellectual and whatnot. And now you see hipsters, and, like, they're, a lot of them are, you know, they're fat, you know, they have, like, tons of tattoos and gauges, you know, and they're just so much like, they have this kind of like cool to be white trash, kind of look to them, you know, whereas I found like the, and they're also a lot more, I think, like politicized in terms of like, of anti-white,
like the
you
social
know,
justice warrior type things.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, back then you had, I mean, you had people protesting, like, globalization and stuff, and, you know, do you remember those, like, Seattle protests from the late 90s? And you had, you know, people protesting maybe, like, early on, like, the war on terror type stuff, and just kind of...
Yeah, I noticed the big change shifted, especially from the Bush era to the Obama era.
Yeah, I think so. I started noticing, I think, probably around, like... 2006 or 2007, just from my time going out, it was also, I started to notice that the music and stuff being played, you know, it went from a lot of this like indie kind of Britpop stuff and, you know, things like Belle and Sebastian, things that you used to hear in those circles, to more of like this, you know, multicultural, like, you know, Mexican dance music and stuff like that. It was just, moved to this kind of like, everything about it just seemed more like multicultural and kind of ghetto. I just mean that, like, the scene from going out, you know, going out for these different DJ nights and things like that, that used to be tremendously popular, and then seeing them over time become transformed into like this, like, just these more ghetto, like kind of dancey, like multicultural events. So it's just kind of like, it was at a certain point, it was just the, it was completely different than what I remember.
And also in the article, Greg points out a stronger emphasis on environmental preservation, healthy, sustainable lifestyles, combating animal cruelty. What are your thoughts on those issues?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that you see in other other nationalist circles in other parts of the country, a lot of them still cling to like the very libertarian kind of corporatism of, you know, no environmental regulations, that's bad for business, the minimum wage and things like that. And same thing, like, you know, anti PETA. So I think that's definitely true. I think that the, you know, my own personal views is that the, I learned to understand, you know, without getting into the science of like global warming and all that kind of stuff, the, The bottom line, I think, is that there are certain segments of society that that really just don't give a shit about polluting at all, you know, and they won't, they just don't care. So it's not really about like whether certain scientific things like, you know, are true, like, you know, arguing about global warming and things like that. The bottom line is that when you have, you know, no environmental controls or very few, the companies always operate and they go right up to the line of what they're, of what they're able to get away with in terms of polluting. You know, it's kind of like before they had sufficient laws and what, you know, companies would just dump their shit right into the river. You know, they didn't even care. Like, so, so I do think that, and I think that, that it really shows if you go into some of those cities in the Northwest. I mean, they really do a good job of preserving, you know, nature. And to where you, you know, if it wasn't for them, you know, there would just be like a Burger King, you know, on every fucking corner. It would just be awful.
Like a lot of the sort of Sun Belt cities, like Dallas, Texas, or even Phoenix, where you live.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Phoenix actually, like within the city, has pretty decent. There's pretty decent like urban like revivalist movement because Phoenix, the city itself, is actually. You know, fairly pro all that stuff. It's when you get, you know, it's when you get out a little ways that it becomes, I don't know, it becomes more like those other cities like Dallas. Dallas is probably a great example because the Texas is probably the worst in terms of you just drive around and there's like a Whataburger and just a, really just a garbage. It just has really a garbage kind of aesthetic of just these endless mini malls with chain restaurants and, you know, just cheaply put up and just tons of fast food places and Walmarts and stuff like that. It's just, and in fact, like we, when I was there one time with someone, there was like we were walking down the sidewalk and there was like this gigantic, like, rusty steel pole just like poked out of the top of the sidewalk, and we just joked about how like, man, if that thing was in you know, Northern California or Seattle or something, like there would be like barricades around it and tons of warnings and whatnot. And yeah, in Dallas they just didn't even bother to, like, you know, they've got this hazardous thing right in the middle of the sidewalk, and they just, like, you know, they just didn't care.
And I guess a lot of libertarians call for abolishing like zoning laws completely.
Yeah, I mean, because it's completely based around individual freedom. That, you know, I see it as if you live in a city, then, you know, then it these things affect you if you have to go outside and see all this stuff and you know, and maneuver around the city, and it has a completely garbage aesthetic, and the air is you know, and different opening different types of businesses in a city definitely. Affects what you attract there. So it's, you know, anyone who lives there should have some kind of a say in it, I think. You know, that's why I'm not a libertarian.
So back to the topic of Robert Heinlein. He had an idea about democracy. So you basically have this concept of democracy where, like, a good example of that is the whole sort of get out the vote movement and the people who, like, want, like, no restrictions on voting, they're totally opposed to any kind of voter ID, their concept is they basically want as many people possible voting, regardless of how well-educated or informed they are. But Robert Heinlein believed, like, in order for people to have a stake in society and a say, they sort of have to prove that they're invested in that society, maybe, like, not necessarily military service, but performs some kind of a community service.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, I mean, definitely who influenced my thoughts on this issue. I completely agree with him. And I think that he does a good job of pointing out why it's not necessarily military or even money, you know, aristocrats and so forth, that what's really important is that the people that have a say in government actually care about the society that they live in and prove that they care about something that's greater than a self-interest. You know, and I think that Starship Troopers really provides the blueprint for that. The funny thing is that a lot of people, when the book came out, thought that it was satire. And he later goes on to say in Expanded Universe that that it wasn't satire, and that he thinks that the, what upset people about it was his idea that not everyone should have the right to vote. And then he went on to explain why he didn't think that everyone should have the right to vote. And then he gave some suggestions which were somewhat humorous and also interesting. He said that you could have a situation where, in order to vote, you'd go in the voting booth and you'd have to solve like a quadratic equation. And then if you didn't solve it, like a buzzer would go off and then you'd have to, you know, walk out embarrassed, so that only people would vote if they would be highly intelligent. And then he also had an idea where people would have to pay to vote, you know, not like a lot of money or anything, just like $10 or $20. And it was just like, if somebody didn't care enough about their society just to pay like $10 or something to go vote, that that it would weed out a ton of people that really would be useless in terms of voting. You know, of course, and you can see where people would object to all of those arguments in terms of saying, like...
Well, the argument that liberals today would say is that that would be discrimination against the poor, or they would compare it to what happened in segregation, where blacks were expected to do these... test, and if they failed the test, they weren't allowed to vote. So that's sort of the argument that would be made against Heinlein's arguments.
Right, and they make those same arguments now that it's like it's racist to expect someone to have to get an ID, you know, to show up with an ID. I mean, you know as well as I do that you can get a voter ID card for like $5 to get a state ID or something. It's, you know, it's ridiculous. Like, is it really too much to ask that someone, you know, I don't care how poor you are, like, you should be able to, you know, provide some form of identification.
The thing is, in California, is illegal immigrants now are granted a driver's license, so they could use a driver's license to register to vote. So you really need, like, a specific voter ID.
Yeah, and, you know, but even with the... with the current options out there, they even think that having people have to show any kind of ID is racist or disenfranchising. So yeah, I can see how they would object to it, but you know, in terms of what we would desire, I think that the you know, much fewer people should be allowed to vote, and whether it, you know, working out the details of how that's a feasible, I think, is you know, is up for debate. But I think that there's no question that, I mean, all you have to do is you know, is study people. You know, go on like YouTube and watch the first 10 videos that come up and look at the comments, and, you know, you tell me if you think that those people are intelligent enough to have a say in our country. You know, I mean, there's so many people who they don't even know how our government works. You know, if you ask them like who the vice president is or something, they wouldn't even be able to answer.
Yeah,
you know?
like you always see those people do those like man on the street interviews, and they ask them basic questions, and most of the people don't even get them.
Yeah, you know, like what does the Supreme Court do, or things like that. I mean, you'd be surprised that it's like, well, they do those videos and stuff, and those are just like, I don't know, they're like funny or whatever, but honestly, that's representative of like millions and millions of people that actually do vote, you know. So I just find that to be kind of horrifying. And I say that as someone that is like, you know, maybe I'm not even intelligent enough to have the right to vote. You know what I mean? Like, for one thing, I'm not very good at high level math. Like, that was never a good subject for me. So if some type of, you know, mathematical equations were required to solve in order to vote, like, I probably wouldn't be able to solve them. Like, I probably wouldn't be able to vote. You know, so it's like, but a lot of these people, you know, they're so dumb they don't even, like, know that they're dumb. You know, it's just like, it's just a total, it's not sustainable is what it is.
His first novel, For Us the Living, which was written in 1939, basically he wrote a lot of speeches advocating for social credit. And social credit is an idea that's kind of been marginalized and discarded, but it was very sort of popular with populist thinkers at the time. I know Ezra Pound also was an advocate of social credit. And basically what social credit is every citizen would get like a citizen's dividend. They would get money from the government, but it's not money from tax revenue. It's money that is introduced through the treasury the same way we introduce money now. And that's basically how social credit works. Are you familiar with that concept?
I mean, vaguely, I would assume that the argument against it would be something around inflation, you know, if it's just you know, money that's basically printed out and given to people. I'm not necessarily opposed to the idea, you know.
And another thing about him is that, so after 1945, and I think this was around the time that the nukes were dropped on Japan, he advocated a strong world government as a way to prevent total nuclear annihilation. But a world government is definitely like a major fear of a lot of political dissidents.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, it seems like it would have been more logical at that time when you had, it's easy to say we should have a world government when, at a time when the U.S. is the most dominating political force in the world, you know, by far, which, you know, in post-war times, that would be, it would have been easy to see it that way without necessarily seeing the negative implications. I think that that's kind of also how people felt in the earlier days of, after the Soviet Union collapsed, is that we were going to have more of this world government. And now, like, we've started to see that what happens is that this these world institutions just gang up on the U.S. and, like, shake us down, you know. And at the same time, we try to use those institutions to leverage against other enemies and so forth, and blackmail countries into supporting us in all kinds of endeavors. So I think that we've seen that the idea of world government has been kind of a disaster, you know, and it's that may have been something that was unforeseen on his part at that time.
And the thing with his work is different political ideologies try to find meaning, their own meaning in his work. For example, A Stranger in a Strange Land was embraced by the hippie counterculture in the 60s, while a lot of libertarians find inspiration in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes back to what I said before, in that, you know, Heinlein was someone you can almost see whatever you want to see in him. You know, that's why so many people like him. And I think that, again, you know, someone who's writing science fiction novel in a large volume of them is going to be conducting all kinds of thought experiments in these various plots. And in terms, you know, who really knows, like, what he really believes? The closest you can actually get to his views are in Expanded Universe. I actually thought that it was kind of funny that Countercurrents article you sent me about, you know, Heinlein for right wingers or something. It was like,
oh, yeah.
It tried to find like some kind of traditionalism in Heinlein's work, and it basically said that, you know, you should ignore everything after 1960 or whatever for him to have a relevance to the new right. And it's like he completely misses all of the things that are actually relevant to the new right, which is the you know, the anti-democratic you know, nationalist stuff that you do, that you see in his work in the 60s. And it's just like, it's almost funny because he completely missed all the stuff that actually is relevant while trying to like squeeze Heinlein in this traditionalist box, just because, you know, he didn't like a lot of the liberal sexualized stuff that came out in the 60s and later, which to me, like the all of the stuff that I'm interested in at his work is basically starts in the 60s, other than, you know, some of the earlier stuff I like also.
What do you think about kind of how the future is depicted in science fiction, comparing different eras, like how the vision of the future in the 1950s and 60s versus how people envision the future today, and how that's depicted, obviously, Heinlein's work, but a lot of different films that are set in the future?
I think one major difference, I think in the 50s and 60s, you saw a lot more of optimism and exploration and things of you saw a lot of bigger plans, I think, and optimistic visions of the future. Even though there were, you know, conflicts in the stories and so forth, you still had I found them to be very much more optimistic in tone. Whereas I think once you get into the late 70s and 80s, it has a lot more of a dystopian feel to it, and like very bleak. Especially when you get into the a lot of the 80s, where you have movies like Saturn III with Kirk Douglas and Farrah Fawcett and Harvey Keitel, you know, a lot more of these bleak kind of thrillers and dystopian. Outland is another one with Sean Connery, with just kind of painting the future as people under these kind of fluorescent lights in these colonies, just kind of living these miserable lives and, you know, and going crazy. I think that's where you start to see a lot of that in the 80s. And, yeah, in terms of now, I haven't really seen too many recent ones, but the thing that strikes me now is that a lot of these movies are just strictly... the stories are pretty much nothing, and they're all about special effects and just very bland, very predictable and cliched storyline. They just aren't interesting at all, especially compared to the stuff in the 60s, which was very, very creative.
So you would describe yourself, are you more of a futurist than a traditionalist?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not really a traditionalist at all, except for occasionally maybe I have some I enjoy like certain traditionalist aesthetics, like a lot, like, you know, medieval fantasy kind of LARPy stuff is interesting to me, but beyond that I'm not not really. I'm much more of a futurist. That's why I like Heinlein and so many of the that's why I'm so fascinated by 60s like space age stuff, because I feel that it was just so much more.
What do you think about the sort of 1950s and 60s space age aesthetic? Like a good example of that would be like the Seattle Space Needle.
I mean, it's awesome, you know, but like 2001 A Space Odyssey is probably one of my my favorite films, but I like the aesthetic from all of that. You know, Journey to the Far Side of the Sun is another good one. I mean, I've Planet of the Vampires, another one. There are so many, but I just think that just the big dreams and the very futuristic and very clean aesthetic and the color usage and all of that. I think it kind of harkens to a time when Europeans had really big dreams. You know, they were going to the moon, and you know, at a certain point, these people were just like, "Oh, you know, like who cares about space? Like, you know, we should just take that money and you know, put it into you know, whatever, some program or something, or even just some like pointless war. This is, it's kind of like they had all of these big dreams, and it was just kind of like they just went, you know, it just went down the tubes. And even when you see interviews and things of people from that era, like as they got older, you know, they pretty much all talk about that, you know, that being the case.
What do you think about Heinlein's views on space exploration and his concept of an expanded universe?
I think that he was very much an advocate of space exploration, and I think that he, you know, he understood that that exploring space is not even just so much about discovering things out there, that it's about discovering ourselves, you know, and who we are. And another point that he brought up, I think he you know, testified before, you know, Congress on some of these issues. And he pointed out that the space program was valuable because it was in the same way that the military was, in that it led to a lot of technological development because it tried to overcome these other problems, and that these other developments had other uses in other applications that we can use. So even though that this technology that this spaceship is using to conduct these tests, you know, that relates back to something we can use in our own medical world, and, you know, hospitals, and our understanding of medicine. And I think that Heinlein also understood that, you know, the Earth is not infinite. You know, it could easily be wiped out in a catastrophe. And, you know, for humans to survive as a species, at some point we will have to begin to migrate out and form colonies in other areas, because it's a guarantee that the Earth is not going to be around forever. It's not going to be sustainable. We just don't know for how long. And
Did he believe that there was life on other planets? I know there's one theory that basically that the universe is infinite, and that there's like an exact replica of our planet somewhere out there just because of the infinite size of the universe. What are your thoughts on that theory, and what were Heinlein's views about towards like life in outer space?
I don't know what his views specifically on whether or not life exists. It's hard to believe that that life wouldn't exist anywhere. I mean, just given the size of the universe and the number of planets and whatnot, I mean, Earth is pretty insignificant if you think about it in the grand scheme of, you know, billions and billions of stars and the planets orbiting them. Now, whether there's any life that we could ever get in contact with that's close enough or anything like that, I mean, it may be something that will be, you know, millions of years before we could even find out. I think that, you know, I don't think that we'll see any advances in interstellar space travel and things like that until we see significant increases in life expectancy. A lot of people think, well, you know, there's no way we could ever get to these stars, or, you know, it's 10 light years away or 20, you know. They're not taking account into the fact that, you know, at a certain point, you know, humans may, you know, they may find a way to completely defeat aging, you know. So if you live for 10,000 years or something like that, then suddenly these journeys don't seem as substantial. So that's why it's kind of like when people say, like, oh, you know, the nearest star is so far away that there's no way that these other aliens could ever possibly visit us. They're so far. Well, you know, what if these aliens, what if their lifespans are completely different than ours? You know, it's kind of like if you look at like an ant's lifespan versus a human, you know, what if these aliens have, you know, lived for like 50,000 years or something? Like, their time is completely different.
One of his book of Heinlein's book, A Red Planet, is actually about a colony on Mars.
Yeah, and Red Planet is most memorable to me because it was one that he had fights with the censors over talking about his pro gun views, which were censored in the novel. Grumbles from the Grave, which was published after his death, like his wife published it, and it was a lot of his letters between him and his, you know, publishers and agent and whatnot. And he throughout it, you see him, you know, arguing with this editor from Scribner's, which was Alice Dalgliesh. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it or not, but for our purposes, let's just say that's how you pronounce it. She was like, always saying that stuff that he was writing in these years, it was like Freudian, and that she was always censoring him. And it's, even if you just looked at the passages, many of them were like extremely, you know, they were very petty. Like, it was just like, so only someone who was really looking could have interpreted something like that to be sexualized or something. But what I found to be most interesting about the censorship battles that he had was that his own agent was always like, you know, when he would complain to his agent and be like, you know, blah, 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 like, I absolutely won't do this or whatever. And then, like, his agent, you know, was always like, kind of like taking the side of the editor, you know, and being like, oh, you know, yeah, you should just take it out or whatever. And then he would, like, you know, Heinlein would give in and just take it out. But I just thought it kind of reminded me of, you know, how we talked about, like, capitalism and how like, you know, corporatism also, its effect on free speech. Like, clearly his agent, like, you know, he was more concerned about, you know, getting the money from this deal than, you know, helping Heinlein take the fight over censorship or whatever. Like, he was always, in his letters back to Heinlein, you could always see him kind of weaseling, like, trying to convince Heinlein to, you know, tone this part down a little bit or make these concessions. You know, so I found that was to me was more interesting about the censorship battles in the letters, was his own agent not really fighting on his behalf. He was an awesome guy. You know, that's about it. And we probably will never, we'll never see science fiction writers at the level of the, you know, the ones that we had in the 20th century, Arthur C. Clarke and you know, Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, and Bradbury. You know, that's like pretty pathetic if you think about what's out there today. The writers that are out there today that are, you know, taken seriously, like compared to those guys.
We are out of time, Rabbit. It's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Take care.